Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Many Americans are busy with their calculators today, finishing up their annual review of what they earned and what they owe to Uncle Sam. It's also a good time to see if you need any financial reform in your household, kind of like the White House wants on Wall Street. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 14th day of April. T-minus one for your 1040s. President Obama plowed full speed ahead on financial reform efforts today. He met with congressional leaders about a bill in the Senate. Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was not impressed.
This is a big, complicated subject, another massive bill that we believe in its current form provides an endless taxpayer bailout of Wall Street firms.
Republicans have started characterizing the Wall Street reform bill as a bailout. Its Democratic sponsors say the whole point is to end bailouts. So, which is it? We asked Brett Neely to find out.
Democrats and Republicans are really arguing over how to let big banks go bankrupt. No such procedure exists right now. Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia helped draft that part of the bill. He says the bill doesn't reward bankers' mistakes.
Because it means they're going to lose their jobs. They're going to have their shareholders wiped out. We're going to let the firm fail.
But fail in an orderly fashion, unlike Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns. The bill makes big banks pay a total of $50 billion into a kind of insurance fund to cushion a bank's collapse. Maya McGinnis runs the fiscal policy program at the New America Foundation.
When financial companies fail, it spreads through the whole economy, and you want to avoid that.
Senator Warner said $50 billion won't be enough in a big crisis. But he said lawmakers compromised with banks that complained any fund would hurt their profits. The Republicans call the bill a bailout because the government would eventually have to turn to taxpayers in a big enough crisis. Bankruptcy expert David Skeel at the University of Pennsylvania says there's another risk in creating a fund. It could fuel risk-taking among big banks if they know a kind of insurance fund exists at all.
That has the effect of reinforcing this idea that there are two kinds of institutions. They're the normal institutions and they're the too big to fail institutions.
Skeel says in a crisis, the insurance fund may get used up. But he says if taxpayers ultimately have to bail out the banks, the government should just present them with the total tab. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Yet another massive quake shook the earth today, this time in China. It struck a remote rural area called Qinghai Province. Hundreds are reported dead. As with other recent quakes, people around the world will want to donate to the relief effort. But in China, where the government exerts tight control over everything, the question is, will they accept foreign aid? Marketplace's Rico Galliano has that story.
Though the death toll may not rival January's Haiti earthquake, the situation in Qinghai is dire. Alex Mahoney is a manager of disaster programs for the Red Cross. He says at least 10,000 people are injured and shelter is a worry.
It's cold there. It's getting below freezing still at night because it's mountainous. So people need blankets, they need shelter, they need food and water.
Even so, Mahoney says the Chinese government hasn't asked for foreign assistance yet, and he says that's not unusual.
Typically, China doesn't ask for outside assistance for disasters very often. The most recent time they did that was the Sichuan earthquake in 2008.
That quake, in which around 90,000 people perished, was supposed to have signaled a new era in China's disaster response. Adam Siegel is a China expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says at first, China rejected foreign aid, but
once they became aware of the massive scope and the huge number of deaths and displacements, then they started accepting assistance from neighboring countries. This was all kind of taken as a sign of both the kind of greater openness from China and also that they had learned from previous disasters.
So will China do the same about face this time around? Siegel says that'll depend on the scope of the damage and whether China is willing to allow foreign relief workers and reporters into a politically charged Tibetan area. Meanwhile, Alex Mahoney of the Red Cross says there is a way for concerned foreigners to give money now.
We have an international response fund, and that enables us to be ready to respond if and when they ask for international assistance and also for future disasters.
In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Over the next few years, health insurers will have to start covering everyone. No more rejecting people because of pre-existing conditions or denying care at the moment they get sick. Logically, that means insurance companies should want their customers to be as healthy as possible. And what's that they say about an ounce of prevention? Well, today, United Health Group announced a new focus on helping folks stay out of the doctor's office. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
United Health Group knows if it can keep us from getting sick, it'll have healthier profits. So it's partnering with the YMCA and Walgreens to get people to exercise and lose weight. The idea is to prevent and control diabetes and its runaway costs. Right now, 44 cents of every dollar United Health spends on treatment goes toward diabetes care.
This program will pay for itself.
Tom Beauregard is a senior vice president of United Health Group. He says the company will spend millions of dollars developing the prevention program. It'll pay the Y for personal trainers to work with people it insures who are overweight. It'll pay pharmacists to help diabetics manage their disease. Beauregard says studies show that a 5% drop in weight can cut the odds of getting diabetes by almost 60%.
We've got to find a way to tip the scale on this disease, and I think we've done that.
All this sounds pretty good to Les Funtleiter. He's a healthcare strategist at Miller Tabak.
As an investor, we look for companies who either improve outcomes or lower costs, and this program would do both.
United Health doesn't just have to please investors. Employers are fed up with skyrocketing premiums. Helen Darling is president of the National Business Group on Health. Darling says companies want insurers to focus on lowering costs.
There's more pressure on them to be more innovative and maybe take more risk than they might have done in the sleepy old days of the 1990s.
Insurers know those days are gone. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a fifth day of gains, thanks in part to all you shoppers. We'll have details when we do the numbers. One big complaint about the new healthcare law is that it's just so complicated, 2,400 pages of political speak. But commentator Glenn Hubbard says there's one simple aspect to it, the fiscal choice it leaves the country.
The new law requires almost $1 trillion of new spending over the next decade. It will worsen the deficit, and it requires the federal government to raise a lot of extra money. Indeed, it raises hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes on Americans with high incomes. And it depends on hundreds of billions in cuts to Medicare. But hold on. Weren't taxes on the rich and Medicare cuts supposed to help to fix Medicare and Social Security? Yes, but that's so 2008. It's 2010, and the budget deficit is much worse. It exceeds 10% of GDP. And relative to GDP, government debt will approach World War II levels in just 3 years. So the bold new health care plan leaves us a simple choice. If we want to keep federal spending on its present course, if we want to pay for health care, Medicare, and Social Security, we will have to raise taxes substantially and on everyone. The shortfall cannot be addressed simply by taxing the incomes of the rich. To raise enough money, all of us will have to pay a consumption tax, like a national sales tax or its cousin, the value-added tax. Unless we change course and slow the rate of growth of spending in Medicare and Social Security. We can do this in a way that maintains a commitment to lower-income households, and we can do this without a large across-the-board tax increase, but we have to start now. The healthcare budget debate was frustrating because it reflected the problem of ordering off a menu with no prices. Many politicians want voters to choose government spending programs without telling them the prices. Others focus attention on the prices, but in a way that makes it hard to figure out what would happen to the choices on the menu. President Obama's health care victory has cut through this confusion. We now must put prices on the menu. Then we can decide between a broad-based consumption tax or limiting growth and entitlement spending. The choice is now simple, and we have to make it.
Commentator Glenn Hubbard is Dean of the Graduate Business School at Columbia University and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. What choice would you make? Go to marketplace.org and share your comments. Today's earthquake in China means more people in need around the world. But as the recession drags on, charitable giving becomes less of a priority in family and corporate budgets. Still, one group of unlikely philanthropists has not been fazed by the downturn. From Blythe, California, Sonata Lee Narsis has the story.
James White is a former Marine and Vietnam War veteran.
I worked my way up to sergeant, and I was awarded a medal by a general.
For 23 years, White has run a charitable organization. But there's one unique thing about his work.
Your heart is open. Stand by for release.
He does it from behind bars at Ironwood State Prison. White is a founding member of the Veterans Group of Ironwood. About 150 inmates belong to the group, and they've donated more than $250,000 in the last decade. They do it by selling pizzas.
And we sell the pizzas to inmates, make a little bit of profit, and then all our money is turned around and given back into the community.
The veterans have permission to do 3 pizza sales a year. They have a lot of customers, about 4,000 inmates. And it's not every day an inmate gets the chance to order their own Domino's pizza. The veterans group makes about $30,000 a year. About half goes to community groups like Blythe Little League and the local Girl Scouts. The other half goes to the Independence Fund. That fund provides support for injured soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. David Long is the prison's deputy warden. He's also a former Marine.
That's the whole mantra of never leaving a comrade behind, you know, going back and taking care of our own as veterans.
3 hours west of Blythe in a Pasadena hotel, Army Sergeant Major Jesse Acosta prepares to give a keynote address. He's speaking to a group that received money from the veterans of Ironwood.
Every time I go up and I speak, it's straight from the heart.
Acosta himself was blinded by a mortar attack while fighting in Iraq. Last year, he heard about the Ironwood Veterans mission and was so moved, he volunteered to serve as the group's outside representative. Back in October, he received a check from the veterans for the Independence Fund.
When the group introduced a check for $10,000, I was like stunned.
A month later, the Veterans Group of Ironwood presented the Independence Fund with another check for $5,000. The money goes towards high-tech wheelchairs for amputees. Acosta says the inmates' donations make a huge difference in wounded veterans' lives.
It means independence. Yeah, they may not have their legs back, but you know what? They have a wheelchair that can go upstairs, downstairs, can go on the beach, can go up a hill, up a curb.
That kind of freedom is something James White can only dream about at this point in his life. He's serving a life sentence for murder, without the chance of parole. But he sees his charitable work as a small step towards redemption.
Just because a guy's in prison, for whatever he did wrong, doesn't make him what he was the day he did whatever crime he did. He may have turned a corner. There's a lot of good guys in here.
In Blythe, California, I'm Sonata Lee Narsis for Marketplace.
Coming up, how vacant homes might help the homeless in France.
I prefer to say we've requisitioned vacant homes. There are more and more empty houses in France, but also in Belgium and Germany.
But first, let's do the numbers. Strong earnings from J.P. Morgan threw fuel on the Wall Street fires today. Stocks flared higher. The Dow hiked roughly 1%, 103 points, to close at 11,123. The Nasdaq powered up 1.5%, 38 points, to end at 2504. The S&P 500 jumped more than 1%, 13 points, to finish at 1210. Higher revenues pushed J.P. Morgan's stock up 4%. The rest of the financial sector followed. Citigroup bounced more than 6.5%. Bank of America added nearly 4%. Goldman Sachs climbed more than 3%. And Morgan Stanley rose 2%. Fast food company Yum Brands chewed on a 1.75% gain ahead of its positive earnings report. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.86%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on industrial production. What's on the horizon for human spaceflight? President Obama talks about it at Cape Canaveral. And of course, tomorrow is tax day. Procrastinating? Think about this. The filing deadline used to be March 15th. You'd already be a whole month late. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigland in for Kai Rizdal. If you've stocked up on aspirin in advance of April 15th, here's another possible solution to your tax headaches. Go get a wad of dollar bills, or maybe a stack of quarters. A new study says handling greenbacks actually helps minimize both physical and mental pain. Kathleen Voss is a professor of marketing at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you take us through one of these experiences and tell us what you found?
In one of our experiments, our participants would come to the laboratory, and their first task would be either counting out slips of paper or counting out slips of money, hard currency. After that, we'd have the participants then engage in a virtual ball tossing game. The participant is not passed the ball, and this elicits feelings of ostracism and social rejection. And we found that after our participants had counted out money, as opposed to slips of paper, they felt less social pain, less rejection, less disrespect when it came to being rejected by those other participants.
So literally just touching money made them feel better about themselves.
Yes, yes. It blunted the experience of what we know to otherwise be a painful event.
So what does that tell you?
Well, it told us that money has pretty powerful psychological effects. And that when people are reminded of money and they feel that they have some money, this means that they don't need to be liked by others. They don't need to be included by other people because they have money to take care of their wants and needs.
But it's not like you were giving them money. They were just touching it.
Right. So the psychological symbolism of money is very deep. And even just mere reminders of money can elicit this construct and activate it in people's minds. And that seems to be enough to blunt the experience of pain.
Now, the experiment that you talked about, you know, blunting this notion of pain, this was just on a computer. But there was one even more dramatic example where you had people then put their fingers in hot, scalding water. And the people who had touched money didn't feel as bad about that as the people who hadn't.
That's right. So we saw the same pattern of results. Instead of in the social pain domain, we moved it to the physical pain domain. And we see the same thing.
Well, so does that tell us that, you know, before surgery, we should have people roll around in a bunch of $20 bills?
I like the image. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the implications. I've given several talks at medical conferences now because, sure, healthcare providers are very interested in the implications of this for how they can assuage pain in their patients.
What do you think would be other potential real-life applications of these theories?
As a person who went through a wonderful but sometimes grueling graduate school experience, I can imagine times before qualifying exams that I might have wanted to handle money or touch money.
But if you're in grad school, you don't have any to touch, right?
Yeah, right. It's the irony, right. We've thought about bringing this into more of an interpersonal realm and having people touch money before they approach someone that they'd like to go on a date with.
Kathleen Voss is a professor of marketing at the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Management. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
At the other end of the money spectrum, more than 8,500 families are living in one or another of New York City's homeless shelters. That's according to the city's Department of Homeless Services. In about 5 months, shelter clients with jobs will have to pay rent for the privilege. The rule's actually been on the books for a while, but the city hasn't enforced it until now. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
It costs about $36,000 a year to keep a family in a shelter in New York City. But the city says this program isn't about the money. Linda Gibbs is deputy mayor for Health and Human Services. She says what it is about is encouraging financial independence.
They have a responsibility to take actions to overcome their own homelessness as well. And so part of this program has been to introduce fees for individuals who are in shelter and earning income toward the cost of shelter.
By individuals, she means parents. Their rent won't bring in nearly enough to offset the tremendous cost of running a municipal shelter system. The rent will be calculated on a sliding scale. Families with no income won't have to pay anything, but a family earning $25,000 a year would pay more than $900 a month in rent. Patrick Marquis is a policy analyst at the Coalition for the Homeless. It's an advocacy group in New York City. He says the city's new policy will hurt these families more than it'll help them.
They're saving money to put down a security deposit on an apartment or buy furniture. And here we have the city of New York saying, no, you're not going to save that money. We're going to take money out of your pockets in the form of shelter rent. That's something that's only going to force those families to stay in shelter for longer periods of time.
He says stable housing has benefits that go beyond having a roof overhead. Kids tend to do better in school, and families are more economically stable in the long run. The city will start collecting rent in October. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
So many homeless people, so many people-less homes. Millions of properties around the country sit empty because of foreclosure or other issues. And it's not just here in the U.S. In France, they're hitting owners of vacant property with what they're calling an empty house tax. Strasbourg, in eastern France, became the first large city to adopt the tax earlier this year. John Lawrenson went to find out how it's working.
Banners, musical instruments, a megaphone and a bus. The caravan of the badly housed, a travelling protest group, arrives in Strasbourg to demonstrate in favour of the homeless. Alain, an unemployed man in his 40s, has already lived a lifetime of lousy housing. He's currently squatting, living illegally in vacant property.
I prefer to say we've requisitioned vacant homes. There are more and more empty houses in France, but also in Belgium and Germany. 5,000 in Freiburg, Germany, 20,000 in Brussels, nearly 200,000 in Paris.
Strasbourg City Council says it has about 6,000 people in Alain's situation, while as many as 10,000 dwellings are lying vacant. In some cases, owners didn't want to pay for necessary repairs. In others, they'd had bad experiences with tenants. And during France's decade-long property boom, buyers snapped up houses knowing they'd make a profit when they sold. Actually using the houses didn't always come into it. For Petra Tumova of the homeless people's pressure group Right to a House, that is scandalous.
If there were not people out, you know, in the streets, it would be good. But there are a lot of people who could use those houses, and we don't understand why those houses are empty.
Strasbourg's city authorities agree. They've told the owners of 1,870 dwellings that have been empty for over 5 years that they have to pay an empty house tax of usually between $1,500 and $2,500 a year. The city's housing chief, Philippe Bies, says the tax will convince many owners to let out their property. There's evidence of this, he says, from smaller towns that have tried it out, places like Reims, the capital of the Champagne region.
Reims, a town not far from Strasbourg, introduced a similar tax recently and it had a big impact. We don't have the final numbers because even there the tax hasn't been in place for long. But it seems they've managed to get a third of the homes empty for more than 5 years back on the market.
The Strasbourg House Owners Association declined to comment on the new tax, but out in the streets, some people said they were against a law that contradicts an owner's right to do what he wants with his property.
There are too much taxes now, so we don't need another one, especially in these times of crisis, and especially for owners. We also are in trouble, financially speaking, so I think it's not a good tax.
But the folks back with the caravan for the badly housed say the city authorities aren't going far enough, and property owners are getting off lightly. They say fines are good as far as they go, but what they really like to see would be those properties requisitioned and rented out cheaply to the poor. In Strasbourg, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, as if ESPN weren't enough of a parody of itself, get ready for The Onion Sports Network. Today, Comedy Central announced it'll start airing the half-hour scripted series early next year. The network's parent company, Viacom, did not disclose the terms of the deal, but said it ordered up 10 episodes. The Onion failed, as expected, to cover its own news, reporting instead on the latest NBA stars to enter the Basketball Hall of Fame. Lakers legend Karl Malone and Scottie Pippen of the Portland Trailblazers. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 103 points, about 1%. The Nasdaq climbed 38 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 rose 13 points, 1%. Our engineers include Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, the challenges and costs of connecting city kids to the great outdoors.
There are like 6 fields to our left that are totally unoccupied. And how many kids did we just see bouncing a ball, shooting hoops, playing double dutch? What do we need to do to get you out here?
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.